next month.
That's what I was told. Now, he brings out a lot of good stuff. On the other hand, he brings up, and I'm right into it right now with slave labor and doing some of the production and everything. And I just, I don't know. That part sort of bothers me, Bob. And I don't
frankly,
know.
Ernst Tullinger has been talking with me going back about, I mean, he called me about two or three weeks ago, a couple of weeks, and he and some of his colleagues, German and American-born, are up in arms over this guy coming here because about what you were saying, they say his bottom line is that Von Braun had complicity in the deaths of 20,000 slave laborers, and it was, I haven't read it, I'm just going by what Dr. Stuhlinger and others have said, but they are really upset. They're preparing to protest to Dr. Franz, not to try to get the thing canceled, but just saying, and they believe in academic freedom and all of that, but
you know, just that here, when you look at right now, the John Glenn flight, when I look at the timing and everything, John Glenn, our hero,
right,
and what he did and what we've all done, and I got to give Von Braun credit and what they did for this nation. They put us in the space business, period. Okay?
Exactly.
And then to bring up this kind of stuff, this many years later, okay, in light of that, it just looks like it's the timing is so bad. See,
I think so, too.
Well, I don't know what you can do about it, but it bothers me.
Well, there's an effort to that I'm quietly involved in because I'm sympathetic to Dr. Stuhlinger's problem with this and his colleagues. An effort may be made to get another speaker on that program who maybe can counter some of the things that Dr. Norfell says.
Mm-hmm.
But Stuhlinger says, you know, the guy obviously has done a lot of research for that rocket in the Reich, but that he writes with a certain prejudice and bias, and that he doesn't factor in the fact that everybody at Peenemunde and the Mittel work, for that matter, was working under a dictatorship.
Absolutely.
And you know, it wasn't real healthy to pitch a fit in protest of anything, or to turn down an SS major's rank
or
whatever,
and
say no thanks.
That's
not too smart.
That's right. Well, they had, in fact, some of my German friends. Discuss that later, but they had people hanging, you know, in the shop. They had them hanging in there, you know, the slave labor. They had them hanging in there
when they suspected sabotage.
That's right. That's right.
And you know that all of that came out with the Arthur Rudolph affair.
Now, he's hard on Rudolph. I just got into that.
Is he?
Yeah, he really. He says Rudolph. Well. I know that's not what you want to talk about.
No, but it's certainly current.
Well, it's current, and then with this guy coming in, and here we've got the John Glenn flight. And by the way, let me call.
Is that? I'm not surprised.
So, they're making a big deal out of it. So, but
it's going to be a huge. What'd you say? 2,500 guests.
Press. And then they've invited. Oh, got just all the senators. Congressman, now how many show up remains to be seen, but it's going to be like a zoo down there.
Oh, I know it is. And this is beside the point, too. John Glenn did the foreword, which is certainly timely.
Good, it is. It sure is.
You know, Dr. Von Braun gets pretty liberal mention through there. There's one, I thought, gratuitous reference early on about that there were a lot of people that considered him just a merchant of death and all too enthusiastic about, it said Dornberger was allegedly an enthusiastic supporter of Hitler, and that Von Braun, there were of course two schools of thought on Von Braun, that one school strongly believed that supported the Third Reich a little too much, and that he was involved in this in brutality, and you know, went on and on and on. And I thought, well, gosh, you're gonna
because of all the deaths caused by the V2, as well as the slave laborers' deaths. And I thought, well, are you going to call our A-bomb developers war criminals? Scientists and engineers, you know, I don't think you can do that in wartime.
No.
I mean, the people behind technological advances, now if you put a pistol to a slave laborer's head, you know, that's another matter. But,
right.
Or hang them.
Yeah.
But anyway, but Huntsville, Alabama is mentioned one time in this 244-page text. Marshall Space Flight Center is not mentioned once in the text. In a little photo caption, and there are two pieces of art that relate to Marshall Center. Of course, there's a lot of Saturn art and Redstone art, but Huntsville gets a little short shrift, although there are a lot of mentions of Von Braun by name and mostly favorable or neutral. But Johnson and the Cape are just all through the thing.
Yeah, they never treat us in fair.
I guess Dr. Von Braun addressed that when he said, the people who provide the power are, what did he say? Are about as sexy as Lady Godiva's horse. I'm gonna put that in there if it's not already. The sexy part is the astronauts.
That's right.
And the thunder and fire at the Cape.
Yeah. Everything I've seen, whether you know they've done the videos or the books they've written, it's always glamorizing the crew. See. And most of them, at least today, now back the original seven, they like that. But today, all the guys that I know and gals that I know, you know, it's always, what is it with the people? It's the team. They're the ones that count, not us. We get all the recognition.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones on the firing line, you know, making sure our hardware's right.
Sure.
Because we put their lives, you know, the GIs and the workers, and they put the astronauts' lives. And so they give us credit, and I appreciate that. And all of them I've known, we have them back here many times. In fact, we'd probably get John Glenn back here. It'd be at least 3 or 4 months after this flight. They usually come back. The crew, they'll want to come back and pass out Snoopy's and shake hands.
Sure.
And have a big thing hard to them.
Well, they know what the truth is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, but I've gone through and I've seen a lot of stuff. The one that I wanted you to check on, and I tried to find where I had a note. Oh, I know where it is. I didn't find it this morning. It was on when somebody screwed up, and I'm going to give you some names, some other guys you may want to talk to and check some of this stuff. And this particular one was somebody screwed up, and it was part of for the guidance system on Redstone. And let's see if I can, because I think I used it in, I gave a talk in the American Institute of Electronics in 95, and I thought I had that story in there about Von Braun found out who the guy was after he fessed up to, he didn't hook up a connection or something, a wire. And what I did, I went back to Hans Fichtner. Now, you may want to call Hans and give him the story.
And send him a bottle of champagne or...
You said champagne, but in mine, I said scotch is what he told me. Even scotch, he went over when he delivered. He stayed there and helped the guy drink it. Now, let me see if I can find that story. But you may want to double-check that one, Hans.
Hans,
that's
Fichtner,
F-I-C-H-T-N-E-R.
All right.
Hans Fichtner.
He's still around.
Yeah, he's still around. Just cut him. I had six you on him.
All right. That makes a better story.
If I can find a thing, I thought I did it this thing here, but I read where, you know, you said he had brought him a bottle of champagne. It might have been champagne, but
Well, that's what somebody told me, I guess, or I read somewhere. But that was on the Redstone, wasn't it?
Right, right. Okay, one of the great stories, well, I'll let you read it. I can make you a copy of it, won't I? Just
all right.
Let me just let her make
that'd be
a
good
copy of that.
All right. Super.
Peter Hutzel.
All right, and that's how you pronounce it, Hutzel.
Yeah, okay. Hutzel. He's a very capable guy, and you can tell him, you know, he may remember me. I hadn't seen him in a good many years, but I think he's written one book or two books. He used to be acting in AIAA. Very capable. He's been retired many years, but he might be able to give you some of the stuff from Penamundo and some of that.
All right. I think I saw him cited in a recent listing of some books related to Penamundo.
Okay.
It may have been in connection with this Norfeld's book.
Could be.
Right.
In the back, I could look and see his name. I got a paperback on that book. You can get it from Books A Million order. For me, it's like $15.
Okay.
My wife got it from me. Another person you might want to check, Ed Molaire. Did you know him?
I interviewed Ed several weeks ago.
Okay, because he was close. He was really closer to Dr. Reese than he was Von Braun, but he was around him a lot.
Let me tell you who I've talked with.
Okay.
Jay Foster, Rocky Clark
and
Jim Odom.
Yeah.
Ruth Von Sarma.
Yeah.
Doretta Schlitt, Rudy Schlitt. She was Von Braun's secretary at Penamundo as a 21-year-old girl.
Bonnie Holmes, have you talked to Bonnie?
I've got a request into Bonnie, Ed Buckby. We all know how reticent Bonnie can be.
Yeah.
She and I have a friendly relationship. I know she's always been very private, though. And
I would think she'd be glad to talk to
so her. I thought I'd just call her up, and Ed Buckby said, well, let me intercede for you and tell her what you're up to. A lot of the old team members are a little skittish with some of this damn Nazi bashing
right,
and everything
going on.
And let me tell, you know, reassure Bonnie that you're not up to any...
He'd be a good one, boy.
Oh, I know. Ed Molaire, Ed Buckby, Connie Dannenberg.
Yeah.
I reached out on the West Coast, Dr. Bill Pickering, William Pickering. At JPL, and he had a story or two, and then Dr. Adolph Teal, who left the team many years ago, Jim Daniels, Lee James.
I don't know Daniels.
Jim was here and in Washington with Dr. Von Braun. He was a speechwriter and a researcher and helped, and some administrative duties he had. Never any big title. Lee James, Dave Newby, Bob Schwinghammer, Bob Lindstrom, Jim Shepard, and Joe Jones. And I have made contact with George von Tiesenhausen, you of course.
Von Tiesenhausen kind of locally here. He kind of fell from grace. He had his own agenda.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I sort of sensed that, but didn't know the particulars of it.
He really never worked close to, you know, helping us with hard. He worked in future projects and stuff like that. Then he had his own agenda. And he kind of fell from grace with the old-timers and a lot of us.
All right.
Here.
Well, I appreciate you telling me that. He has not... I ran into him in a restaurant about a week or two ago and mentioned what I was up to, and his first reaction was, well, I don't do interviews. And
I dropped. I wouldn't wait.
And then I called him a week ago, and he has not returned my call.
Well,
I'll skip him.
These others, you can get a lot more. Anybody else?
Chuck Lundquist.
Yes,
I'm going to talk to tomorrow. Dave Christensen.
Good old Dave.
Bill Lucas, I have plans to talk with. Werner Dahm, somebody suggested.
Yeah,
Slidell. And we have talked a couple times, and we're gonna do the interview in a couple of weeks. He's been going. He had a lot of damage, frankly, in Slidell, and they have a home at Gulf Shores, and it got damaged. So he's General Johnny Zert.
Yeah, I don't know if he knew Ron Ross. A lot of, unless you go back to Top Toy or to Madaris or some of them, those guys came after him. I don't know. It's
right.
Really good to talk to them.
Well, he's been recommended to me by somebody, and I called him up, and he said, yeah, I've got a few stories have never really been published
good,
or told.
Good,
and
good,
so
good.
I thought I'd give him a... Leland Ballou.
Yeah,
Leland's
good.
Possibly I've contacted Dr. Hauserman, Walter Hauserman.
Yeah, he's good.
Somebody suggested Harry Pennington. Ernst Stuhlinger. Stuhlinger, I'm going to talk to after I finish reading his biography of Von Braun.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Reisig, someone suggested.
Gerhard Reisig.
Gerhard.
He was kind of almost outsider. He wasn't a hardware guy. He was more mathematician.
Okay.
A scientist type when he was here. He was sort of a loner, hard to get close to. He's not a friendly guy like Stuhlinger, okay?
Right, I
he's
see.
He's warm around him. He's just an interesting guy to talk to.
Sure.
Reisig seemed like a little bit like Von T and I, like your brother.
A little person. And then this afternoon, I'm going to talk to two of Dr. Von Braun's pilots, Ed Grubbs and George Feller.
George. Live out my neighborhood. Yeah, that'd be a good one. So, and I'll give you a couple of stories on flying with these guys.
All
back
right.
Back in those days.
Good.
That'd be good. Well, you can look at that at your leisure. Let me give you.
This is good. Thank you. I like this story better than the other one.
Let me a couple. And I'm not sure on some of the stories how to do it, but. I remember, and I want to double check. I did ask Swing yesterday, but Von Braun's saying, late to bed, early to rise, work like hell, and advertise.
Okay.
Right. You don't have to write. I'll give you this sheet.
Oh, all right.
And he used another one. Skin was so thick. You know, Von Braun would say that you could stand in a corner without a backbone. You know, you got to be able to.
Right.
Have thick skin to put
mm-hmm.
up. But he really, you know, he believed in and he preached to dirty hands. So dirty hands, a day-to-day approach, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
hands-on work. And I'll give you these. I'll give you this thing here.
All right.
He had this is just, you know, the guy had a doctorate in physics, but to me, he was a hands-on engineer, Von Braun. I'm going to give you this.
All
I'm
right, good.
Read it, but then... his charismatic, visionary spirit, you know, his ability to set in high-level critical meetings, you know, where we would have, and I'll give you an example if you come back to it, like Apollo 8.
All right.
Where he cut through and would focus precisely on what needed to be done. So, and why don't you just keep this.
All right, great. Yeah,
you can't read my writing.
Good.
You call me. I started.
All right,
I
got sure
tired
I can.
Up this morning. But let me give you
a test.
Yeah,
I understand.
And we still do that and carry that philosophy. The Germans always did that, but you can only analyze so much. But we really need to test. And I'm always, you know, even today with the analytical models that we have
mm-hmm.
in terms of doing analysis. Now, in those days, it was slide rules. Today, we've got all kinds of computation.
Computer models.
Right,
yeah.
Absolutely. So today, you know, we still want to test to verify what the analysis says. We do that over and over and over. So let me give you a couple, and I'm not sure. They're kind of funny, and some of them relate to flying, but we went to McDonald in St. Louis during the Mercury days. I was with them with Von Braun, and we went to look, and it was in the early days of Gemini.
Go ahead.
But we were at McDonald's, and course, Von Braun always prided himself as being a hotshot pilot, and he was, you know, he would fly everything. And did get qualified for multi-engines, et cetera, and many times, you know, we'd be going somewhere where he'd be sitting up in the left-hand front seat. And that's how he knew those pilots.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, while we were at McDonnell in St. Louis, then they put him in a simulator, and this was the F-4 Phantom simulator, okay?
Right.
And I mean, he thought he was a hotshot pilot, and he flew that thing in the ground twice. And he talking about give him the raspberry. We all there, and the McDonald folks, of course, give him, you know, we gave him the raspberry and a hard time about it. The thing was too hot for him. But that was in the early days when they were developing the F-4 Phantom jet. Another one, we had gone to Van Nuys, California. This was in the early 60s. We'd had an incident on the S-4B. Now, S-4B is the third stage of Saturn, and this was McDonnell. That was Douglas up at Sacramento. They had a test stand up there, and they wiped out the J-2 engine, and that was a 200,000-pound thrust engine.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did, Von Braun called his buddy Kurt Debus at the gate and says, hey, we got this investigation. You probably don't have to chair it because you'd always get somebody on my side to chair the investigation. So he said, how about letting us borrow your jet? He had a Lockheed Jetstar that he chartered from Lockheed. Now at that time, we didn't really have the G1 like we have here now, the Gulfstream that he flies. So anyway, the plane comes in, picks us up at Redstone. I think it was six or eight of us. We flew from here to Van Nuys, California to meet with Rocketdyne, who made the J-2 engine. So then we go from there up to Sacramento, and we meet with the Douglas guys, look at all the debris and everything. It's really a mess. And my job was in propulsion. That's the reason that I tagged along. But coming back, see, we left there to fly nonstop, stop from Sacramento back to Redstone. I was really impressed with the young engineer, you know, I mean, here, first time I've ever been on a jet, a little private jet, they fly on a jet, period.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a young fellow on there, he was a Lockheed employee, and of course the two pilots were Lockheed employees. So I asked him, I said, well, could you tell me something about what's the thrust of the engine, head full engines? And I said, tell me something about the, you know, the things in the, on the plane there. And he said, okay, wait a minute. So he goes off, he's gone about 10, 15 minutes. Pretty soon he comes back and he's got this brochure, and he hands me this brochure. And man, it's got all the details about the thing. Well, the last page in there, Bob, has got a certificate, and it said this is certified that A.A. McCool did fly in Sacramento, the Redstone, Huntsville, Alabama, ground speed so-and-so, altitude so-and-so, and it's signed by the pilot, Werner Von Braun. Here he comes out, and he ain't been checked out flying jets. He comes out, had the big old shit-eating grin on his face, and I still have that in my mental field.
That's great.
So here he is flying his Jetstar, corporate jet, if you will.
Right.
So I don't know how you make something funny, you know, the way you do it here when you put things that won't do and bonds of science and so forth.
Sure.
Maybe want, whatever you want to do.
Right.
Have liberty. In fact, use that with any of these stories.
That's
great.
I don't
know if you can make, well, of course, you got what I said there. With the,
sure. I'll probably not use the shit-eating grin,
Now, another time we went to New Orleans. We flew down to New Orleans. It was going to go down and back. It was on our G1. It's just a prop. But then we get down to, that was at Michu, and we were building, you know, Boeing was building our tanks and first stage and everything.
Right, and the G1 was what, a Gulfstream?
Sure. You still fly that, it's he used to fly it.
It's prop.
Yeah, it's a
right.
Turboprop.
Right.
And we still fly it, and he used to fly the thing. And it's a good, you know, if you go to California, in fact, we went there 2 weeks ago, it'd take you 7 miles. It's a long time.
Right.
You have to refuel and all that.
But I have heard of him in the Gulfstream.
That's it. It is. And we got it back. And when you talk to those guys, it would be good. That thing's got, I bet, 25,000 hours on it.
Is that right?
Yeah. But we were going to go down to New Orleans, see, to, we call it the Michoud Assembly Facility.
Right.
There where we, Martin builds the tanks now. But we get down there, and he decided he wanted to go up to, in those days it was called Mississippi Test Facility, where Stennis Space Center is today. And we were testing the cluster up there, and of course J-2 engines, doing those tests up there. So he decided he wanted to go over there, so he says, hey, Alex, you need to come with me, you know, the propulsion guy. So they get a car to take us up there, and we go. But then the next thing, you know, he decides he's going to fly to the West Coast. See, well, so I didn't have any need, and they didn't want me to go to the West Coast, or he didn't ask me to go. I would have gone, if he said. So anyway, I'm stranded down there in New Orleans. I didn't have a toothbrush, and I had a $20 bill in my pocket, and I had to get home. Well, luckily, at that time, my brother worked there in New Orleans for NASA in the resident office, so I stayed with him and spent the night with him, and then they helped me get a ticket to come home. But that's one of those trips like that, when you go in, you never know where you're going to go, what he would want to do.
Right.
See, so I got stranded down there. See? Another one, that's not a flying thing, but we were in Washington, we were on a headquarters meeting, okay?
Right.
And what he did, we got ready to leave NASA headquarters, go back to the National Airport. We took a cab. Well, I think there was he and I in the front seat, because I sat in the middle and there was three in the back, so there was, what's that, five of us. So he asked the driver, the taxi driver, stop in front of one of those booze stores up there.
Mm-hmm.
And which he did, he stopped the liquor store. So now the reason is, I found out later, that you could buy better variety, and it was cheaper than what you could get in the state stores in Huntsville. So when he gets in, he's got an armful and bags and everything, so he hands me a bottle, you know, when he gets in the cab. I'm still sitting in the middle. We had to wait till he got back in. So after he gets settled, pretty soon the driver's driving off. So then he grabbed a bottle, see, from me. So
mm-hmm.
He said, let's not make a mistake that it wasn't for me, that bottle. He didn't realize that I was a teetotaler. See, I got in, wouldn't want it anyway. But I had that bottle there.
Uh-huh.
So he said, let's don't make a mistake. So, I mean, he was serious about that. After he got settled with these other bags,
right.
We were going to the airport.
In other words, don't make a mistake that you thought I gave this.
That's
to you.
It. That's right, Bob.
He just gave you to hold it.
That's right.
Now, we all were traveling by NASA plane back. Yeah.
Go back to NASA,
right.
See, from headquarters, but we had taken a cab, and like I said, there was five of us, and I'm sitting in the middle by the cab driver. See, and he told the guy to stop by the liquor store.
Sure,
so he'd go
right,
in, he'd
you had to load up.
And he loaded up, and...
But that was only to hold for
only
a minute.
Only to hold, you got it, you got it. I had remember that, let's see. Another one, and I'm not sure about this one, and I used to work for a guy named Bruno Heusinger, H-E-U-S-I-N-G-E-R. He died, and Von Braun was one of the pallbearers at the Church of Nativity many years ago, had brain tumor. But Bruno told me the story. He was my boss, a little short guy from Essen, Germany, and he worked with him over there. And when they were over here, they wanted to go back and get married. He and Von Braun went back, and Von Braun was going to marry Maria, his second cousin, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the name of the city where they were. And they did. They went back and both got married.
Bruno did
and Von Braun at the same time. And they stayed at the same hotel, and they had MP soldiers guarding them and standing outside, you know, while they were in the hotel or where
mm-hmm.
they were. Bruno told me that story years ago. He's dead.
But it was same town, same hotel.
Yeah. And I think the concern was more not so far as them. You see, at that time they were still under contract over here. They were not citizens. That probably has something to do with it, you know, because they really work for the Army. Secondly, we're worried about whether the Russians might kidnap them. We don't know.
Right.
But it never was clear. Now, Bruno was the one that told me in the factory where they saw some of the guys, you know, some of the slaves that they hung and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about how rough that was. Yesterday, this thing, I don't know if there's some way you could use it. Ann gave me that. She said, I got to give that to Bob. Just take it. It just got in the mail. And I said, well, let him take that picture.
It's bad.
But if he didn't show the picture somewhere, that would, just think about
all
that.
Right, you don't need this. All right, great.
And if you need it, we could probably find that picture. You know, we in our archives,
mm-hmm.
we might be able to find one for you if that's not good enough. Why don't you
tell them? All right.
I know they don't like to use a lot of pictures, but, you know, the secretary, she wrote that for me yesterday. I said, well, I'm going to say that, give that to Bob.
Oh, that's good. You might. I hate to interrupt you. I'll show you later. Right, it sure does.
I'd be anxious to get a copy of that. And I think the book will do well. I think you got a good chance of getting something. There's nothing out there like that. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was saying.
It's all the human side.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of, when we talked with you about shuttle, that's what I had in mind. I mean, people, you know, you hear a lot about the astronauts and the heroes and all this stuff. Well, what is the real interesting, the fun stuff? What's
uh-huh.
all the stuff that went on behind the scenes? What's the personality? Because that's when you really get to the stuff that's interesting to people.
Right.
I mean, that's good. And I
right.
think there's a need for it. I think you'll do well with it.
Well, thank you. That's that's along the lines of my thinking, too, that it needs to, it kind of fill a little void out
all
there
right.
about the man and the program and
that's right.
or
that's
programs.
Right. Yeah.
I did some of that.
Well, I can give you another story if you
want. Oh, listen, I would love it.
Well,
it looks like I'm only in the anecdote business, but I am doing a straight. I don't know if you ever saw that.
No, I never did.
Thank gosh, that came out in 82, and Cronkite was good enough to do the introduction.
Really?
But I started off with the shuttle anecdotes, because, we're finally back on the road again, you know, in
uh-huh.
space manned space flights in 82. So,
John Young, good. landings are definitely smooth in water landing. You don't have to swim near as far. Good old John, he's still around. We see him all the time. See, swings, kind of swing hammer, I tell people, he's our John Young. I introduce
right.
Roy Bridges, the center director down there, who's ex-astronaut, when he first came on about a year and a half ago, I introduced him to Bob. I said, Roy, I said, Bob, I introduced Bob, I said, he's our John Young. I said, he helps us.
Right.
And I said, we always look to him, and he keeps us focused and everything. He said, well, I got to get me one of those. I'd like to read this sometime. I wish I could find a copy of this is good.
I don't know if John Shaver, it's out of print, but I think John Shaver may have a copy or two, and I'm down to just one or two copies.
No.
You know, Shaver's bookstore on Whitesburg there?
Yeah.
John may have, he got some calls for it recently, and I gave him sort of my last supply.
I like stuff.
But
I'll
of course, there's a lot of Huntsville material in there. But I interviewed people all over the country.
Yeah, yeah.
For that.
I'll call.
All right.
If he got it, just tell him to hold it for me.
Sure.
Let me tell you one about John Glenn now, and it's kind of appropriate, but it really ties to Von Braun and what I said a little while ago about him being able to set high level meetings. And I'll come to the one if you want on Apollo 8 to tell you about that one.
But all right.
This one is more towards, and this was in, Kennedy had already permitted us to go to the moon, okay?
Right.
Before John flew. And it was, now he flew February 20th, if I remember, 1962. Space Task Group was still at Langley, and they were getting ready to move down to Houston, okay?
Mm-hmm.
At that time, a handful of them, Bob Gilruth and Fajay, a bunch of them went down there. So they were at a motel. They had rented this motel, and that was their offices down there. I don't even know where it was. So at that time, now this is this happened right after John Glenn's flight, the story. But the big flap was, how do we go to the moon? Did you go Earth orbit rendezvous, or do you go lunar orbit
mm-hmm.
rendezvous? JSC was sort of leaning towards lunar orbit because some of the Langley guys back then had proposed that. And Von Braun's thinking that some of our folks are thinking Earth. But headquarters had a gang out, they had academia, they had science committees, all kind of stuff. Biggest flap, and it drug. So Von Braun decides we're going to go down, and they had this Huntsville Aviation. Now, we didn't have planes back then. We're downtown, the old airport.
Right.
And they had an old B-26 that they leased or something. That was going to be, and we rented the plane. They had their own crew on there from Huntsville Aviation. And Von Braun, I think it was six of us. He took me because I was proposing, Louie Richards, Mrazek. I'm trying to remember who else on the thing. Anyway, to make a long story short, we get down there, but he says, here, as we fly down, he says, I'll let you read my speech. So and it's the noisiest plane I've been on my life, Bob. So I'm reading this thing, and the bottom line was he was trying to team up and go LOR, and that was going to be a thesis of what he said and
mm-hmm.
reason for doing all this other stuff. So we go down there, and John Glenn's in there. Here we are at lunch before his speech, see? Meeting and everything. The meeting was to try to see how we're going to go and what to do and so forth. But I'm sitting next to John Glenn. I'm in awe of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
What a hero.
Sure.
And then John's telling some stories about when he and Ted Williams were flying in Korea and some of that stuff. And real interesting. And one thing that I remember with John, he was saying most people at that time, you know, when you get in your 40s, you're sort of over the hill. But he and Ted Williams, the last of the 400 hitters, both pilots, you know, and Marine pilots and so forth,
right.
are not over the hill. And when I contrast that to today, and a guy's almost twice that age and still flying, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So but that's kind of an aside. So Von Braun, and that, but I'm in awe with him, and we tried to get him to come.
This is after Glenn's flight,
Glenn's
of course.
Flight,
right.
Yeah. So it had to, see, he flew the 20th, so it had to be, I don't know, a few weeks after that. But he, when I sat next to him in this little dining room, they had a just a couple of tables, wasn't any of us there. But I was just in awe of this guy. Golly, that young guy, he was my hero and still my hero. So Von Braun gets up and he talks and goes through all this, you know, discussion of LOR versus EOR. But the bottom line was he was going to get Bob Gilruth and ourselves signed up and get headquarters. So he was cutting through all this stuff and force the thing and get academia and all these places. These other outfits to say, yes, let's go LOR. Well, it wasn't too long after that, see. He was able to get Bob Gilruth because he wanted to go LOR.
Mm-hmm.
We teamed up with him. But Von Braun, you know, knew if we could get the two of us, then they'd get headquarters and the rest of the world to sign it.
Then it needed to be decided one way or the other.
Right.
But, and I understand that Von Braun felt that if you went EOR,
mm-hmm.
that would set you up better for Mars missions and other, you know, planetary missions.
That's right.
He was looking ahead, okay,
yeah.
But if you just want to go maybe the better way for lunar landing only,
mm-hmm.
that lunar orbit would be better.
Right.
So he kind of sacrificed maybe the long view for the immediate mission.
That's right. See, he's a visionary. He always
mm-hmm.
thinking what he's always thinking ahead, okay? Just like when he was fooling around with the V-2 and all that. He was thinking about space.
Sure.
He was a visionary, already looking ahead.
Right.
And he would do those things. Well, he had to do it. You know, it was all working for the Army. Same thing with us in the Redstone days, see?
Right.
Now, he was a visionary also. A lot of people don't know. I remember we and some of the work I did in the 50s, he already had the idea of a suborbital flight like Al Shepard flew before there was any kind of mercury and that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he had, it was a sense of course we worked for the Army in those days, And I was, my job was to size the tanks and look at in terms of propulsion, what kind of performance would you get for this. And I went out to Al Zeiler, who was one of the German, he had a launch and ground support equipment. And he's dead, but the two of us went out to Ballistic Missile Division, and we showed them. I carried some classified stuff. He called it Project Manhigh. Von Braun's idea, and what it was a concept just to fly, just a suborbital flight, just up and down a ballistic path, which is what Shepard eventually did anyway when Mercury came in.
Right.
He was on top for Redstone. That was his idea. But ultimately, he really wanted to put somebody in orbit and be able to go, like you said, into space.
Right.
But he was always looking ahead.
So you're, when you when he handed you that speech copy, that was your first knowledge that he was going to try to get everybody on LOR.
Right, right. When we were on the plane going down, and we didn't know why I was going there. And my job was to describe, you know, back in those days, what the propulsion system would look like. I covered that, all the propulsion part. Dr. Morozzi, William Rotsey, he did also. He covered all the structural design and everything. Luda Richards covered the guidance system, electronic stuff. That was kind of the three of us that described our stuff, or what the design looked like on Saturn.
Right.
For him, but then we got through, then he gives this speech. That was the thing, our stuff wasn't so important. They wanted to know what we've been doing, and of course they described all of it, we described it.
Sure.
So, but he got the decision after that. It wasn't long. I think that's about it. I was trying to remember other stuff like
Have you seen or did I send you copies of that Alabama Heritage magazine?
Yeah.
I don't know whether Mike Wright, who did that, I thought he did a good job. If he interviewed you, okay. But I don't need to get you to repeat the same things I guess you told Mike. There may be something I want to quote you on.
Hey, just take it.
There.
No, don't worry about that.
No point.
Okay. Whatever you want to do, any of this stuff and that I sent there, you just use.
Right.
Don't worry about it. Just be
but I'll probably want to credit the Mike and that magazine or at least once. As the source, but Mike, I want to find out, he interviewed you for that article, didn't he?
Yeah, he
talked
to him at least twice. He liked
okay.
He was talking about some of the stuff on Saturn, what we did there and all that, but if you don't, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, if you want to use this and just give them credit, if you want to say, I talked to McCool and he told me this, whatever's simple for you, whatever he quotes me in here.
All right, very good.
Just use my stuff, cause just like we're talking now.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
See, hopefully your thing's going to go out. It ain't going to be something just in Alabama. Hopefully yours is going to appeal to space people.
Hope so. And yet, Mike's done a straight narrative history here, and I'm just going for these anecdotes, whether they're humorous or whatever, with a you know, kind of a point to them, a kicker line somewhere. And so
he's dead.
You know, that's the same. Isn't that the same picture that they took? I thought I recognized
that's
that.
It.
Same one.
But I'd use that, and I wouldn't necessarily give them credit.
Right.
You know, because if you want the picture, I think we can get the photo lab get a copy of the picture. Any of this stuff where I know it's underlined, but I was looking to see if any place that you see my name, just use it.
All right, great.
But I wouldn't get involved with this thing or even Mike. I mean, you're talking to me and it's my stuff.
Okay, fair enough.
Whatever's simple for you.
All right,
great. That's the thing. Keep it simple.
That's true. Except, you know, ethically I need to probably give some credit there, maybe just once or
whatever you want to do is all right. I mean, make it simple though. Anytime, you know, where you could see you've talked to Swinghammer.
Right.
So, I mean,
And he told me about the same thing. He said, yeah, anything that's in there that you want to quote me on, you know, yourself, that'd be fine.
Yeah.
But Dr. Von Braun did love, he loved to take the controls over, didn't he, in airplanes.
Yeah,
he
loved
to fly. I've heard about that.
Yeah. See, here's this thing he mentions, and I, you know, the idea of a professor, calling him professor rather than Dr. Von Braun,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was a higher title. And
is that where he talks about dropping that,
you talking about
dropping that title, or?
Well,
Oh, yeah.
For a long
exactly.
time, we would call him. He'd come in, everybody would stand up, you know, and he was professor and rather than doctor, you know. Now, the inner circle
right.
would call him by his first name, you know, the original lab chiefs and so forth. He'd call him Werner. I could never call him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I used to call him professor, and then he said, no, call me doctor. You know, he never did say. I remember Widener told me he'd call him Herman, but most of them, I'd call them, you know, by their old Mr. Mrazek or Mr. Schulze. There's a good one. You may want to talk. W.A. Schulze. S-C-H-U-L-Z-E. S-C-H-U-L-Z-E.
Okay.
William Schulze. He lives on Hermitage.
Like, would that be Wilhelm or?
No, William.
William. He lives on
Hermitage. And he's a real fine guy. And just, if you call him, he's in his 90s now. He was my boss. You got a moment? Let me give you the story on him.
All right.
Show you how he used, and I never have forgotten that. He was my first boss when I came here. And when I came here in 54, I went around. There was a lot of interviews and so forth. But then I went to where Al Zeiler, what we call launching and handling, they actually worked under Hans Hüter. At that time, Hans Hüter had all the ground support equipment. You know, that's the tanks,
yes,
the propellers,
right.
all this stuff for tanking. So they offered me 3 different jobs over there. I never will forget that. Then I went back to the laboratory, and Lindstrom was kind of the administrator. He'd gotten out of the Army, was administrative assistant there in the lab. Dr. Rattle was the lab chief. So anyway, he sends me to Hans Paul, P-A-U-L, and he's dead. He had a thermal group. Well, he kind of talked to me like I was a kid out of college and everything, and I got turned off. Eventually, I ended up working for him for many years. Then I go see Mr. Schulze, and I remember he had his desk bucked up against another desk, and Herbert Furman sat in front of him, and all I could think, that guy looks like Himmler. I mean, boy, he hit me with them piercing eyes and everything, and I'm sitting there being interviewed by Mr. Schulze.
Mm-hmm.
So, what he does, he takes out this drawing, and all I see, man, I'm impressed. He lays this on there, and here's this look like a missile of some kind, and it's sitting on a pedestal, and there's a bunch of trucks and lines and everything. So what he does, he puts his arm on it, he says, we work on this up here. the missile, okay? Not all this. He knew I'd been over launching the hand.
Right.
Here's all this ground support stuff, tankers and lights and all that. Boy, the light came on like that guy taught me something I've never forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Schulze. But he'd be a good one to talk to.
All right.
Tell him that Mac, his buddy Mac, you know, and you tell him Alex McCool.
All right.
Referred you to him. That you would appreciate if he'd give you a few minutes if you could come out to his house, okay?
All right.
And interview him.
Speaking of your name and everything, are you Alexander? I mean, your full name?
Yeah, but hey, you know, let me give you a...
All right.
But he either call me Alex or Mike.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter to me.
All right, good.
You know, officially it is Alexander, but whatever it is,
right.
don't worry about it. Whatever. And I don't need a lot of credits or anything like that. I don't need.
That's fine. I'll do just the normal writing thing.
Whatever it is. Just you take that. Just keep that.
Was there anything you said we needed to come back to on here or?
No,
trying to remember if there's any other. The one, it's more towards his character and leadership, managerial. We had, after, I was trying to think which Apollo mission, I'd have to go look, I could dig it out. It was prior to Frank Borman's Apollo 8, okay? They have all hands down here, it was over in a building, largest conference we have. George Miller came, Sam Phillips, Jim Phillips was here, Patron, Beavis, Bob Giroux, all the key, Donald Douglas was here, all the key president, company presidents. And what it was, we'd had on a previous mission, it was just a line that hooked, actually carried propellant to an igniter, and it broke on us on the previous flight on the second stage and the third stage. Well, we knew what it was and we was able to fix it. But the question was, do we let him go to the moon? Now, that's Apollo 8. So we had the big shindig, and again, I was invited, just working in propulsion to that thing. And, you know, it was a lot of agonizing and sweating and everything. Of course, Juan Braun, you know, sitting in this critical meeting, and he knew what we had done to try to understand the problem, okay, and be able to fix it and convince ourselves that we qualified and we knew it was going to be okay. So we all signed up to that in that meeting, but he was really the inspiration and the leader. I mean, here's this audience, all the company presidents, they're key people. You had people like Debus came up from the Cape, Giroux, all the headquarters people. And that's when we signed up to be able to go around them with Frank Warren.
I got you.
And I've talked to Frank, you know, since then. In fact, before he flew, he called me the engine man. They used to come up and then we'd tell him what the engines would do and all this stuff. And I ran into him a few years ago down there. He retired, left Eastern Airlines and all that stuff. We talked about that. And the thing that I liked about that whole thing, Bob, is when they read from the book of Genesis on Christmas.
Oh, wasn't that moving?
It was. And I have never forgotten that. And it still touches me to this day to know that, you know, for them to go around and how that helps, see, what it did for us.
And it helps so much with public support.
Absolutely.
Today it would be considered politically incorrect, probably. You know.
Well, I mean, that's right. Reading the Bible. You know?
Sure. But still, it was a master stroke,
yeah.
And it came across as very sincere.
That's
on
right.
Their parts,
that's
too.
That's right.
And it captured the whole, I mean, space exploration involves the cosmos.
Right.
I mean,
right.
how big can you get? And all of creation and the creator and all of that. So
right.
They just captured that
right.
Spirit, I thought, extremely well.
See, Von Braun, he gave, I had for many years, I think I had a lot of his speeches back then. Talk about science and Christianity. He gave talks.
Mm-hmm.
He believed in the Creator. He was very spiritual.
That's what I've been advised.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I think I have copies of those speeches back from those days. I don't remember the guy that used to help his speech writing. It was before Joe Jones. Now, Joe would know that. I was trying to remember.
Well, you know, Guy Jackson and... who passed away, Foster Haley, who's still with us.
I was trying to think.
Amos Crisp used to write some.
Well, who had the job as Joe Jones?
Bart Slattery.
Bart Slattery.
Okay.
Have you ever talked to him?
Bart passed away some years ago, and I didn't get to talk with him, you know, about any of these, any of these books.
He
I've
was
done.
The one I was thinking.
Right.
Bart Slattery.
Right, he was head of public affairs.
Yeah, back then.
Let me ask you about this. I have read that in line with the Germans' philosophy of test, that the team on developing Saturn V wanted to test fly, wanted to flight test, I guess, elements of
right.
it, rather than going all up.
All up.
And George Miller is
right.
said to have overruled
right.
Von Braun.
Dr. Von Braun take that?
I thought he took it well. See, he wanted to go through the methodical thing.
Exactly.
We always did that, you know, build up to it.
Sure.
Because recognizing there's so many problems and so much risk, okay, so the thing is step by step by step. But if you look at it from what Miller's perspective was, you know, we had a task to be able to do that before the end of 1969, and just looking at the schedule, and he figured, Miller, the gamble and the risk was worth it.
I see.
And so Von Braun we just, once they said, let's go do it, I never heard him say anything negative.
I see.
Didn't hear anything about that phrase or anything. No,
Apparently the Apollo fire, was that 201 or whatever it was, Apollo fire, had a lot to do with that. Earlier, maybe it could have been step by step, but that cost some time.
A lot of that was...
Of course, that didn't involve the launch vehicle.
No, that was only the capsule.
Right.
And Reese was involved in that investigation, and Ed Muller can give you a little background if you want to.
He has, in fact, and I knew of how... Ed told me a great story about the moment, the private moments where Dr. Von Braun, Webb was administrator then.
Yeah.
Webb came down and met with Von Braun, and they decided at Webb's suggestion or insistence that Eberhard was going to be the man to head up this investigative team and to troubleshoot the capsule, the spacecraft, and that they called, or maybe it was Jim Daniels, either Ed or Jim Daniels told me this. I've got it in my notes. Anyway, they called Eberhard down, and Von Braun told him, you know, he was being volunteered to head this thing up, and that Dr. Reese took it like a soldier and said, of course I'll accept that, and then Webb left, and that then Eberhard's face just fell, and that he kept saying, Werner, you didn't tell me. Why didn't you tell me? In other words, before he was brought in there and hit cold with this. And maybe Dr. Von Braun didn't foresee that that was going to be the demand by Webb, but that Eberhard was just crestfallen that he was hit with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, I mean, he knew it was going to be a tough, dirty, mean job to go in there and fix all that trouble. I don't know that I would use it. Makes an interesting story, but it's not really. I mean, it's more about Eberhard Reese than it is about Dr. Von Braun.
Right.
And I'm focusing on Von Braun here. But anyway, I thought it was interesting that was his reaction. But then he went and did a hell of a fine job.
He did. Now, I was out there at Space Division, for the second stage of Saturn, see, the same company, that was North America.
That's right.
The second stage. We had all kind of problems. And I spent 3 or 4 months out there. And in fact, Ed and I were real close in Malaire. Funny thing, one time, a little sideline here, Reese was coming to town, and he didn't have a clean shirt. So I said, he borrowed one of mine.
We stayed
at the Apollo Motel, which was like 2 blocks from the factory. $6 a day, you had a little kitchenette and all that. I mean, that was our home. And I never will forget that time. But the story is, a lot of it has really never come, I don't think it's come out. I really blame the company themselves, for the shoddy workmanship. And I mean, they found, you know, tools in there. They found, you know, wires that were not, you know, properly grounded, insulation. Corollary to that, and if you can visualize a tank, I'm going to show you how it was for the second stage. In other words, if this is the second stage,
and this would be the other one up here. But what the tank looked like.
Right.
Then you come on down here, and then you had taut lines that come out and so forth. But what we did, what we found out, now this is on the S2, the second stage of Saturn, right in this area right up here, we had them go x-ray that thing, and they found pins, combs, pliers, scissors, conundrums. You never seen so much stuff around there. This thing's 33 feet in diameter.
Right.
And the workers are up there just dropping stuff down in there. Well, what we worried about when you pressurize this tank, what's going to happen if you got a tool or something laying there? You're going, because it's a thin membrane. And what
now, it's inside the skin?
Yeah, inside. See, this is right down in this joint.
Oh, I see.
Around.
Right.
That's the skin there of the skirt. But in between that, it comes down to where it's just a notch there.
Uh-huh.
See, they tried to. They got a lot of stuff out, but a lot of stuff they couldn't get out, and we had them x-ray the thing. And then what they did, they x-rayed this all the way around, and they put it up in the factory there of all the stuff that they saw in there so the people would see it. They had the x-ray picture.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's 30 feet by diameter.
Right.
So you get the circumference, which is two times the diameter.
Heavens. Now, Everhart was not involved in
the shoddy workmanship, knowing it was the same thing with these guys. Now, they were in a hurry to ship this thing to Mississippi,
because
this is what we call the test, S2T, test bird, which eventually they ruptured down there. That's another story. But they were in a real problem with getting it down there and getting it set up, and then I ended up down there for 4 or 5 months myself full time, helping to get this thing in a test. Well, it